My name is Shao Kai. I'm from the Institute for Advanced Study, and I'd like to thank Yincheng for inviting me and also for the introduction. Today I'm going to talk about how to realize supersymmetry in condensed matter systems. This talk is based on this reference, and first of all, I would like to thank my collaborators, Professor Hong Yao from Tsinghua, Joseph Mosiuczko from University of Alberta, Ngu Moon from KAIST, and also postdoc Yi Fan, Qian Hong, and Shuai. So my talk will be divided into three parts. In the first part, I will talk about emergent supersymmetric quantum electrodynamics on the surface of topological insulator. The second part is about emergent 3 plus 1D SUSY in the lattice model. In the third part, I will talk about multi-universality in pair density wave transition of wild semi-metal. We all know symmetries play a very important role in quantum phases of matter. Conventional matters are distinguished by their broken symmetries. For example, there are anti-ferromagnets breaking spin rotational symmetry. There are also superfluid and superconductors breaking particle conservation. And there are also phases that cannot be distinguished by symmetries. These include long-range entangled topological phases like fractional quantum Hall states and quantum spin liquids, as well as symmetry-protected topological phases like topological insulators and topological superconductors. But today I will focus on another perspective of symmetry, the emergent symmetry. That means symmetries in low energy are enlarged, are usually occurring at critical points or in critical phases. There are many examples of emergent symmetries. Lorentz symmetry can emerge in Dirac fermions in graphene and Weyl fermions in wild semi-metal. More interestingly, even gauge symmetry can emerge. For example, quantum electrodynamics, even quantum chromodynamics can emerge in frustrated magnetic systems. All these symmetries have their counterparts in particle physics. So a natural question is that, can we realize in condensed matter system the symmetry that haven't been discovered as fundamental symmetries in particle physics, like supersymmetry? So SUSY is a fermionic symmetry, which means it has Grassmann number as generators. But don't be bothered by its fermionic nature. This just means it exchanges fermion to boson. The fermions and bosons that are exchanged by supersymmetry transformation is called superpartners. Whenever you have a fermion in a supersymmetric theory, you must have a boson which is the superpartner of this fermion. Space-time SUSY has spinner as generator. So here I list some simple superalgebra of these spinners. I will not go into details of superalgebra, but just to mention that it is different from quantum mechanical SUSY, which you can view basically as SUSY in the time direction. But space-time SUSY, we have this index, the spinner index, which involves both time and space. There are some necessary elements in a space-time SUSY theory. The number of fermions must be equal to the number of bosons, since SUSY exchange them. And the bosons and fermions that are superpartners must have identical masses. That is because the generator commute with the mass operator. And the theory must be Lorentz invariant as well as translational invariant, because SUSY is an extension of Pancari group. So let's look at some simple examples in 2 plus 1D. Let's first consider superpartners between complex boson and Dirac fermion. The simplest theory you can write down is the Gaussian theory, which involves both complex boson as well as a two-component spinner. So there are two parameters in this Gaussian theory, which are the velocity of boson and the velocity of fermion. So Lorentz symmetry requires the velocity to be the same because we have only one speed of light in the Lorentzian invariant theory. If the velocity are the same, the Gaussian theory is already supersymmetric. One can straightforwardly check this action is invariant under such transformation. Note that the variation of boson is proportional to fermion and vice versa. So supersymmetry indeed exchange fermion and boson. Here, eta is a Grassmann number. So altogether, this is a bosonic particle. Eta just parameterizes the supersymmetric transformation. So this is Cassie. We can add some interaction to the Gaussian theory. For example, here I add a Yukawa term between fermion and boson, as well as a Phi-4 term. Besides the Lorentz symmetry, supersymmetry will lead to additional relation between these couplings. For this theory to be possibly supersymmetric, we must have the relation where U is equal to G squared. Then this theory is just a massless West-Zumina model. In the last example, let's look at gauge field. So gauge field is a boson. We know we need a fermionic gauge field to be superpartner, which is usually referred to as Gaugino. A pure gauge theory in 2+1D involve a gauge particle and a real scalar and a Gaugino. We know in 2+1D, gauge boson has only one real degrees of freedom. And combined with this real scalar, we have actually two real degrees of freedom, which is equivalent to a complex boson. Then we know we need a two-dimensional spinner to be its superpartner. So lambda here is the Gaugino, which is a Dirac spinner.
Excuse me? Yep. In the previous example, is it obvious that supersymmetry requires U equal to G squared? So
this example, yeah, supersymmetry require
you. I believe you, but is it obvious? Is it simple to understand? So if I look at the term with G, it's third order in the fields.
It's what?
It's the third power of the fields.
This is third power of the field, yeah.
And the other one is fourth power.
Yeah. Then.
And I'm trying to understand why I would see a relation. Is that a perturbative statement or?
Actually in Suthi theory, people do not work in this component field. They work in super field. So in terms of super field, this is very natural. It's just a cubic term of super field. Then you expand this super field into its components. You have G squared of this term. I will talk about that later more.
It's related to this. So the supersymmetry transformation that you have up there doesn't seem to leave the action invariant in this language, right?
No, this is not for this. The Suthi transformation is different for different field theory. Yeah, it's different.
Oh, I see. It's very good. Okay.
So why is supersymmetry interesting? For particle physics, Suthi is useful to solve many fundamental and mysterious issues. It helps to solve the hierarchy problem, and it can explain the small mass of Higgs boson. It is useful for grand unification, and it provides possible candidate for dark matters. But the evidence of Suthi in particle physics is still lacking. Recent LHC experiment seems negative in finding Suthi. For condensed matter physics, Suthi will put more constraint to the theory, and exact result can be obtained even in strongly interacting fixed point. So can Suthi emerge in condensed matter systems in low energy and long distances, even though microscopic models are not supersymmetric? The answer is yes. There are many known examples of emergent SUSY, especially in 1+1 dimension. For example, the tricritical points in the dilute icing model. There are also examples in 2+1D. These include boson fermion mixtures, as well as critical point on the surface of topological insulators and superconductors. All these examples concern about the matter field, and all these examples focus on low dimensions. So there are nature questions. Can we realize supersymmetric gauge theory, such as SQED in condensed matter system? I will show you that SQED3 indeed can emerge at the tricritical point on the surface of topological insulators. The second question is, can we get SUSY in three-dimensional lattice model? Our previous example focused on low dimension, like 2+1 and 1+1D. And I will show you that SUSY can emerge at a pair density wave transition in 3D wild semi-metal. Let's first look at how SUSY emerged on the surface of topological insulator. We know the surface of a TI hosts Dirac fermion. So here is the simple Hamiltonian of Dirac fermion. We have two components, spinner, and gamma here is Pauli matrix. The gaplessness of Dirac fermion is protected by time reversal symmetry as well as particle conservation. For this theory to be supersymmetric, we know we need a superpartner, which is a complex boson. How to realize a complex boson on the surface of topological insulator? A possible way is to consider superconducting transition, where we need a complex boson to be the order parameter describing such transition. And people have considered this example, and the effective theory at this critical point involved order parameter and Dirac fermion and their couplings. And they have done an RG calculation to figure out that the fixed point is described by West Zumina model, where here U is given by G squared.
What is G in this?
G is just interaction.
But in terms of the original model?
Which one?
But you started with some topological insulator.
We don't have, actually they don't have some microscopic model device. Actually there is a paper. Yeah, there is a paper by Zixiang. And they study indeed using Monte Carlo to simulate the surface of topological insulator. And you can get the scaling dimension for both fermion and boson. And they verify that the transition indeed fall into the supersymmetric fixed point. You cannot just write down a parameter here. It is not physical. What is physical is the scaling dimension, for example, which is measurable. Yes?
So here you're saying U to be G squared because that's the requirement to have supersymmetry.
No, that's the result of flow equation. So.
Okay, okay. Yeah. So you're saying that in the low energy fixed
yes.
point, G equals U.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Okay.
But the surface of a TI only require odd numbers of Dirac cones. So we can ask a further question. Can we realize SUSY on TI surface with three Dirac cones? The material like SMB6, it hosts three Dirac cones on its 111 surface. So this is the surface Brillouin zone. It is hexagonal and it has three distinct endpoints. Denoted by 1, 2, 3. So these endpoints are time reversal invariant point. And the Psi is the Dirac fermion. So now we have three gapless Dirac fermion. We need another three complex bosons at the criticality for this theory to be possibly supersymmetric. Then how can we get three complex bosons? We need to figure out what symmetry we should break to have three complex bosons as order parameter. So the underlying symmetry is particle number conservation, translation, as well as C3 rotation. The answer is we need to break all these symmetries to realize a transition which requires three complex bosons as order parameter. So how to see that? Let's first consider U1 group. The order parameter of U1 group is just a complex boson. But now let's write down three complex bosons. Then these three complex bosons must be reducible representation of U1 group. We need to consider these two groups. Let's assume these three complex numbers transform under C3 as permutation. So these three complex numbers will be split into two irreducible representation. One is trivial, it's one-dimensional representation, and another is non-trivial two-dimensional representation. But it is not good enough because we need a three-dimensional representation. So we can assign quantum number to these three complex bosons. We can assign momentum to them such that these two irreducible representations will mix with each other under the translation transformation. And then we can get a irreducible three-dimensional representation. So what is the state that break both particle conservation as well as transition, or as well as translation? The state is the pair density wave state. Exactly. I consider a pairing state in superconductors with spin singlet pairing. It will depend on two positions. We can recombine these two positions to the relative position as well as the center of mass. So delta here is the amplitude of the pairing state. For a conventional S-wave superconductor, delta is actually a constant that does not depend on the center of mass. The pair density wave state is such a state that the delta is no longer a constant. If you do a Fourier transformation, you can find out that for pair density wave state, it is finite momentum pairing. Here, the pairing momentum is Q and minus Q if you consider time reversal invariant pairing. And this Q dot R will give you a modulation in real space. So it naturally breaks translation symmetry.
Does it break rotation symmetry as well?
Rotation?
Yeah.
In generic case, no. But in our case, it will break rotation symmetry. So the pair density wave state does not necessarily break rotation symmetry. Its definition is just breaking both U1 and the translation.
I guess if you want to keep rotation symmetry, you should put this momentum Q at some high symmetry point, like K point.
I saw your five three come with different momentum, right?
This is, I mean, in a generic pair density wave, you can have like a three-dimensional case. If this Q located at a high symmetric axis, I mean, it does not necessarily break such a symmetry. If the rotation just map Q to minus Q, then this does not break rotation symmetry. But how can we get pairing state from three direct cons? There are two ways to get them. The first way is intra-valley pairing, which you just pair Psi1 to Psi1, for example. And the momentum carried by such intra-valley pairing is two times the momentum of Psi1. And now we know psi 1 locates at time reversal invariant point. So say the momentum is k. Now the intravedi pairing carry the momentum 2k. But k is equivalent to minus k because of time reversal invariance. Then 2k is equivalent to zero. So intravedi pairing does not carry any momentum. Then we only need a complex number to be order parameter. On the other hand, we can have intervalley pairing to get the pairing state. For example, let's pair psi 1 and psi 2. And the pairing state phi 3 carries non-zero momentum. So the intervalley pairing is pair density wave state. How many states can we get from intervalley pairing? It is, there are three possibilities. So the mode counting is good for PDW. Namely, we have three derived fermions, psi 1, 2, 3, and we have three complex bosons coming from the intervalley pairing. So now let's consider these three complex bosons. And the question is, what kind of PDW state can we get?
Sorry, can you go back one slide? So those three files that you have done there, they clearly break U1 and translational symmetry. But it seems that under a C3 transformation, they map to each other, right?
Yes.
So then you still have the C3.
If I just condense one of them, then C3 is spontaneous.
I see.
So the boson potential up to fourth order allowed by symmetry is given here. In the quadratic level, we only have a mass term. Note that the charge 2e, Josephson carbon is not allowed. Such term is not allowed because it carry non-zero momentum. In the quartic level, we have three terms. The U term describes the amplitude coupling between two complex bosons. While U prime is the charge 4e Josephson coupling, which is allowed by symmetry because we know 2k is zero. That means this term does not carry any momentum. And U double prime is the conventional phi 4 term for each of the complex boson. To analyze the ground state, we can absorb U prime to the definition of U because U prime just lock the relative phases of between the different complex boson. If we neglect this term, now we have two terms, U and U double prime. We can recombine these two terms into such form that this form has SO6 symmetry. It does not have any preferred direction. While the last term here breaks this SO6 symmetry and picks some preferred direction. If the prefactor is negative, then the preferred state is such that three complex bosons will have same magnitude to minimize the symmetry because this coefficient is negative. The resulting state is isotropic PDW since we do not break the rotation symmetry in this case. On the other hand, if the prefactor is positive, and only one of these three complex bosons is preferred. Because, say, let's assume phi 1 is preferred, then phi 1 is non-zero. But phi 2 and phi 3 are zero. So the last term just vanishes, and it does not cost any energy, and it is preferred. This term is pneumatic PDWs because we break C3 rotation. Now there is a bicritical point separating isotropic PDW and pneumatic PDW. Here is a schematic phase diagram. As a function of U1 and U2, which are some microscopic parameter we do not specify. So indeed, there are two phase transition to isotropic PDW or to pneumatic PDW. In above analysis, I assume U double prime is positive. Now let's look at the transition between direct semi-metal and the pneumatic PDW. there is actually a tricritical point separating second order and first order transition. This tricritical point is characterized by the vanishing of U double prime. This can be seen from the fact that if U double prime is negative, so say this term is negative, and we consider the transition to pneumatic PTW, the last term will vanish as we said before. Then we need a sixth order term to bound the Hamiltonian from below. So in the theory, we have a negative quartic term and positive sixth order term. Then this will lead to a first order transition. Whether the transition is second order or first order depends on whether U double prime is positive or negative. So the case U double prime vanishing corresponds to the tricritical point separating these two kinds of transition.
Question. Can you say a little bit more on throwing away the U prime term? So I guess without the U prime term, it looks like the theory has some, I don't know, U1 cross U1 cross U1 symmetry, which looks different.
Yeah.
So is U prime somehow irrelevant?
Or? Yeah, it's irrelevant.
Okay. So is that seen through some calculation?
Yes, I will show that. So our strategy is to write down the effective theory at the transition and to see whether SUSY can emerge at some fixed point. Now the effective theory involves three terms. L0, the first part is the kinetic term for three Dirac fermions and three complex bosons. The second part is the Yukawa coupling between fermion and boson. Now we have inter-valley pairing. So we have, for example, Psi 2, Psi 3 coupling to Phi 1. And this is cyclic permutation. And in the last part, we have the boson potential, which consists of three quartic potential. And for this kinetic term, we have the Hamiltonian. So actually, there is no symmetry to relate different velocity along different direction. For example, let's just write down the Hamiltonian for this Dirac fermion. There's no symmetry to relate x direction and y direction. So generically, we have different velocities for this Dirac cone. And this, so are the velocities of other parameters. But there are just two velocities for fermion, because once we write down the Hamiltonian of Psi 1, we can use C3 rotation to get the Hamiltonian of Psi 2 and Psi 3. So are the bosons. So in all, we have two fermion velocities, Vx, Vy, and boson velocities, Cx, Cy. And we also have the Yukawa coupling and the coupling between bosons. So that's the...
I have a silly question.
Yep.
If your theory is supersymmetric, can you relate the scaling dimension of the fermion and the boson field?
Scaling dimension?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have to be the same?
Yes.
Okay, if that's the case, then why should... We should add like a psi to the four interaction as well, right?
You mean this one?
No, psi.
Psi to the fourth.
Yeah. If they have the same scaling dimension.
Yeah, actually, I have done this. The scaling dimension is actually not different.
Okay.
But the enormous dimension is the same.
Okay. Yep.
So they will require the same quantum correction, but the bare, because of the bare term, you have different scaling dimension. So we will see the energy flow of these parameters. So for velocity flow, I won't go into details of this complicated RG equation, but just mention the result. We have actually do a perturbation in the difference between the velocity along different directions. And there is only one stable fixed point characterized by Lorentz invariance, namely when these differences are vanishing, or the difference of fermion and boson along different direction. And the velocity of fermion and boson should be the same at this fixed point. We have another bunch of other equations for coupling constant. But from this other equation, there are two fixed points. One of them is a stable fixed point characterized by this equation, characterized by this relation. That is nothing but the bicritical point we introduced before. Interestingly, there is another tricritical point where we find that U prime and U double prime both vanish, and it corresponds to the tricritical point I introduced before. And there is an additional relation between G square and U. They are equal at this fixed point.
This is one loop result, right?
Yeah, it's one loop.
Have you looked at R loops?
Well, I mean, if SUSY emerges at one loop, and if you preserve the scheme well, then there will, then it is stable up to any order.
Is there an easy way to see that?
There is no reason to expect another fixed point, since you have already a SUSY fixed point. I mean, the fact that this SUSY fixed point is stable, you can tell the fact in one loop calculation, whether it is stable or not, because higher loop just doesn't matter.
Right, so the at this fixed point, the theory is supersymmetric for any epsilon?
This one?
Yeah.
But yeah.
Okay.
Yes. So let's look at a fixed point action at a tricritical point. So we have a kinetic term for fermion and bosons. And we have the Yukawa coupling between them. And we also have the quartic potential. So this Lagrangian is invariant under the following SUSY transformation. And it is the supersymmetric XYZ theorem. I will give you a very naive explanation of why this theory is called a supersymmetric SYZ theory. Don't be bothered if it is not clear enough, because it is not essential in my talk. So in supersymmetric theory, people use superfield to construct supersymmetric action. One kind of superfield is called chiral superfield. It's shown here. It is very complicated. Anyway, you can regard this term as a complex number. Then a supersymmetric Lagrangian is constructed as follows. So we have, so now we are talking about SYZ theory. We have the kinetic terms. So this first term is just the canonical kinetic term for fermion and bosons. And the second term give rise to the interacting part. So this term is called superpotential. We can see from superpotential why this theory is called SYZ theory, because the superpotential is just the product of SYZ. So now there is a duality between SYZ and SQED3. For n equals 2, nf equals 1, SQED will flow to an IR fixed point with three chiral superfield, say V plus minus and M. And it is described by the following Lagrangian. So one can immediately check that this is nothing but the SYZ model. So with the help of this duality, at this tricritical point between direct semi-metal and PDW, we actually realize the supersymmetric QED in the low energy.
you're realizing supersymmetric QED of a super but not formal fixed point.
You cannot distinguish SQED and this CFT at low energy, since there is not even quasi-particle.
One's a conformal theory and one isn't.
Yeah. So I mean in the IR. We just realized this CFT.
Right.
Yeah. UV is totally different. UV, we are in the surface of topological insulator. It's nothing about all these fields. So what is the consequence of emergent SUSY? So the scaling dimension is known exactly for complex boson as well as Dirac formula. So you can get like a correlation function at criticality. Some of the critical exponents are known. Here we know the enormous dimension. While nu is not known exactly, this is just one loop result. Another interesting quantity can be get exactly is the zero temperature optical conductivity. So in a CFT, the optical conductivity is a function of the ratio between frequency and temperature. So zero temperature limit leads to a universal number for a given CFT. So we have evaluated such number at this SUSY fixed point. And all these results are hopefully to be measured in experiments.
So this number is some sort of OPE of that?
Yes. So let's move to the second question. So now we consider 3+1D case. Let's first give some introduction to wild semi-metal. So wild semi-metal, the low energy physics of wild semi-metal is described by two non-degenerate bands touching at discrete points with linear dispersion. So here's an example of such a characterization. So psi here is two component spinner, and gamma is still Pauli matrix. To realize wild semi-metal, either time reversal or inversion symmetry should be broken. And the wild point is protected by translation and the particle number conservation. There is a famous fermion doubling theorem saying that wild points always come in pair in 3D lattice model. So let's just assume there are two wild points locating at plus minus k, which I choose as generically incommensurate moments. So to be possibly supersymmetric, we should have two complex bosons as super partner of these two wild points. The underlying symmetry is particle number conservation and translation. But breaking either one of these symmetry will require only one complex boson to be super order parameter. As a result, we need a transition breaks both G1 and translation symmetries to realize two complex boson. And we already know what the state it is. It is the pair density wave state. Let's assume there are two wild points locating at plus and minus kz. The pairing is a little different here because we are now consider incommensurate momentum. So intra-valley pairing is PDW state, while inter-valley pairing is a uniform pairing state. And for two valleys, we can get two intra-valley pairing. Then how to realize such a model? So we construct a lattice model. Here C is a spinful electron. And we design some spin orbit coupling such that in a low energy, there are two wild points at some incommensurate momenta. So the effective Hamiltonian of this lattice model is given by the Weyl Hamiltonian. But here we have different velocities along different directions because there is no symmetry to relay these velocities. In order to get a PDW state, we need interactions. Indeed, we add an attractive Hubbard interaction to the Hamiltonian, and we perform mean field calculation to get phase diagram. In presence of this attractive interaction, there are three possible broken symmetries. The first one is just a uniform pairing, which breaks only U1 symmetry. And the second one is CDW, which breaks translation symmetry. The third one is the PDW state, which is what we like. So out of these three possible states, only PDW ordering will fully gap out the wild points. So we expect PDW as the leading instability out of wild semi-metal. Indeed, the mean field phase diagram shows the transition from wild semi-metal to PDW state. Now the question is this transition supersymmetric? We implement the same strategy, namely we write down the low energy action and analyze its RG flow. So here we have three parts. The first part is Weyl fermions for two valleys. Note that we have three velocities along different directions, Vf, X, Y, Z. The second part is boson part. Again, we have three velocities of bosons. Now we have also the quartic potential. Namely, we have a 5-4 term as well as the coupling between two condensate. Here, charge 4E Josephson coupling is not allowed by translation symmetry because this PDW located at incommensurate momenta. The last part is the Yukawa coupling between fermion and boson. So in total, we have six velocities as well as three parameters, three coupling constants. I will not go into the details of the RG equation, but just show the result. So we have actually emergent Lorentz symmetry. So all velocity flow to be the same value. And the figure on the right shows that all the coupling constant is marginally irrelevant, which is often the case in the quantum field theory in its upper critical dimension. So in the end of the day, we get a Gaussian theory with free fermions and free bosons, but they have identical velocities. As I have said before, the Gaussian theory is supersymmetric if the velocity are the same. So here we realize two copies of n equals to one space-time SUSY in 3 plus 1D. What about Weyl semi-metals with more than two Weyl fermions? Here we consider actually NF Weyl points, where NF is equal larger than 4. In the effective theory, the only difference is that now the charge 4E Josephson coupling is allowed in this theory. And this charge 4E Josephson coupling is actually marginally relevant, and it will lock the relative phases between different condensate. And this will destroy the emergent SUSY. So for more than two Weyl points, the PDW transition cannot realize supersymmetry in a low energy. Now, what are possible ways to realize this microscopic model? For the cubic lattice model, we can we can potentially realize in a codatom, in optical lattice. And a strong attractive Hubble interaction may be achieved by batch bus resonance. We can also search for ideal wire semi-metal with two wire points in solid-state materials. But in solid-state materials, one should worry about the effect of long-range interaction. So for a conventional Fermi liquid, the long-range Coulomb interaction is not important because of Thomas Fermi screening. So the potential is now short-ranged because of the screening coming from the density of state at the Fermi surface. More specifically, the screening length is inversely proportional to the square root of density of state at the Fermi surface. But in wire semi-metal, the density of state is proportional to E squared, where E is the difference from the charge neutral point. So exact at the charge neutral point, the screening length will diverge. That means wire semi-metal fails to screen Coulomb interaction at charge neutral point effectively. So if one calculate the RG flow of, say, finite structure constant, one will find that this constant is marginally irrelevant. This will lead to a marginal Fermi liquid in wire semi-metal. So the question is this UC stable against long-range interaction? To answer this question, let's just add another part to the original action. So this SE is now long-range Coulomb interaction between charge density. Rho here is the charge density. So there are a bunch of parameters, say the velocity ratio and the original coupling constant. Now we have a new coupling constant characterizing the strength of Coulomb interaction. This is just the fine structure constant. And we investigate the RG flow of these parameters. So here is the RG flow equation as a function of velocity ratio and the ratio between alpha and G squared. You can see that there is a fixed point which the velocity ratio is 1. And G squared over alpha over G squared is 0. And from this, we also plot the RG equation, the RG flow as a function of log energy. So T is actually logarithmic, is the logarithm of energy. The smaller T is, the lower energy the system will be. So in an extremely low energy, we can see that the velocity ratio flows to 1 asymptotically. And alpha over G squared flows to 0. So what does this mean? This means the Coulomb interaction is almost negligible compared to the Yukawa coupling. And the velocity flows to 0, meaning that we restore Lorentz symmetry at low energy.
So it seems there's a repulsive fixed point?
Yes, I will talk about it. So if the Coulomb interaction is small enough, the SUSY fixed point is stable. So the fixed point action is still this Gaussian fixed point action with the same velocities.
So what controls the corrections to alpha over G squared? So how can you tell that it is always negligible? This is just a one loop result, right?
Yes, actually, all of these parameters flow to 0 logarithmically, and the perturbation is done in these parameters. That means both alpha and G squared flow to 0, while their ratio is 0. It's like a 0 over 0, but it's very small. So yeah. So actually, there is a runaway flow. If alpha over g squared is large enough, you can see this runaway flow. Indeed, there's another fixed point. If you plot large flow diagram as a function of g squared over alpha instead of alpha over g squared, so this fixed point is characterized by the vanishing of g squared over alpha as well as the vanishing of velocity ratio. If we plot the flow as a function of energy, we can see asymptotically this velocity ratio flows to zero. We can also plot the RG flow for various ratio of coupling constant. We can see that all these ratio flow to zero asymptotically compared to alpha. That means the low energy physics is dominant by Coulomb interaction.
So I have one technical question. So yeah. This Coulomb interaction is clearly non-local when you write it in the action, right?
Yes.
So when you go to Fourier space, that's singular at k equals zero, right? But there's no screening. So how do you deal with that in this computation?
You mean the Coulomb interaction?
Yeah.
So actually, we write down the, so we do a Hubbard-Stoltonovich transformation to introduce another boson. And this is the
masses, right?
Yes. And this is a static boson, which does not have frequency dependence. It is an instantaneous interaction, so it does not have frequency. And then we do the RG, the conventional momentum shell RG. Actually, we do not touch the zero, Q equals zero, because we do a cutoff, IR cutoff. Both IR cutoff and UV cutoff in this.
Isn't that problematic? Because you're looking at the IR physics and you just put in an IR cutoff by hand, right? I agree. If you put a UV cutoff, it's okay. But you're somehow screening your Coulomb interaction.
Oh no! Actually, that is not so. This is people usually done in momentum shell RG. You have a IR fixed point. You have a IR cutoff, and then you let this IR cutoff to be zero. You integrate out the faster mode in the momentum shell, and you gradually let this cutoff to be zero. Then you generate such RG flow.
So just want to make sure. So the calculation is controlled as long as g squared and alpha are both small.
Yes.
And you don't care.
We don't care about the ratio.
Okay. So in this diagram, what does it flow to up there?
It flows back to this one.
Oh. Okay.
So, yeah. So now, because the velocity ratio approaches zero at this fixed point, there is no emergent source anymore. And because the physics is dominant by Coulomb interaction, we expect marginal Fermi liquid behavior. Indeed, we calculate the inverse lifetime, which is proportional to the frequency up to some logarithmic correction. And we call this fixed point critical marginal Fermi liquid fixed because it is a critical point. And the fixed point action is still Gaussian action, but with different velocities between of fermion and boson. So here it is a very interesting scenario that there are two stable fixed points at the same critical surface. The fixed point action is Gaussian theory, but these two fixed points are different because the velocity are different. This is a phenomenon called multi-universality. which says that a single quantum phase transition can exhibit distinct critical phenomena. Or once you compare it to duality, if one finds two different field theory describe the same quantum phase transition, one will say that these two field theories are dual to each other. However, here we indeed have two different universality class, depending on the initial value of these parameters.
Sorry, you're confused with the dimensionality. This isn't 2 plus 1 and...
Oh, sorry. This is a mistake.
Okay.
This is 3 plus 1.
3 plus 1,
yeah,
okay.
Yes.
So, I need to make sure. So the real distinction between the two fixed points, one doesn't have Lorentz invariance, or...?
Yes.
Okay.
And the logarithmic correction is different for all the physical quantity. So here comes the conclusion. We'll talk about SQED3 and SUSY in 3 plus 1D and microscopic models as well as this multi-universality. With that, I would like to thank you for your attention.
So we have some time for questions.
I'm still puzzled about the SQED3 results. So you say it's one loop epsilon expansion, right?
Yes.
And then you claim that the theory is supersymmetric for any epsilon. But if that was the case, I could have assumed that the 2 plus 1 dimensional theory is supersymmetric and proceed from there, right? But you can't, because then your interactions are relevant in 2D, right? So what's, or in 2 plus 1, I guess. So I'm a little bit confused about that statement. So you find a supersymmetric fixed point to leading order in epsilon, right? And then you say that the theory is supersymmetric for any epsilon. Is that the statement or not?
For any, for any loop.
Okay, but that doesn't mean for any epsilon, right?
So physically, if epsilon can only be one or zero.
Yeah.
So there is a SUSY in 2 plus 1D, but there is not a SUSY in like a 2.5 dimension.
But can I see from the perturbative computation that when you said epsilon equals 1?
Yes, I just said that it equal to 1.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that SUSY fixed point is always there. The question is whether this point is relevant or irrelevant. I mean, stable or unstable. You can always get a supersymmetric theory for our theory, for our Lagrangian. The question is whether this supersymmetric fixed point is stable or not. And the result, whether it is stable or not, does not depend on higher loop correction, because higher loop just too small to change the stability of this.
If epsilon is small.
Yeah, if epsilon.
That's what I'm
comparing. Oh, I see, yeah. So it is a perturbative calculation.
Presumably, all this requires setting the chemical potential to be at
yeah.
neutrality, right?
Yes,
so
yes.
Is there a natural way to do it realistically, or is
that? Well, yeah, for the bulk system, it is more easily to do that, but for the like the TI surface, it's very hard, I think.
So for this marginal from a liquid, are the critical exponents known exactly or
atomically? Yeah. It is just Gaussian theory.
Yeah.
So it is a free theory with some logarithmic
correction.
And you can get the logarithmic correction also.
You say it's marginal. Do you actually get a finite density of state, or it's?
No. It is, it is not that marginal Fermi liquid. People often mention to in the like high temperatures. Okay. The density of state is still vanishing.
Any more questions? That's not. Okay.